Welcome to episode 18 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, education, and we don't have anything here.
And Artifet Smith.
And Artifet Smith. It's not happened yet.
Oh, that's true.
Preparations for Artif. Okay.
How about we start again?
No, this is... Move it. We're late.
We just go.
Got to do it.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT podcast.
Today,
so, as usual,
administrative. Administrative. Today we're recording on September 13th. We're still trying to get our act together and get back on schedule. And we are struggling.
I think we're making really good progress.
Oh, I think we are. I feel like I'm still a few steps behind every time we get going.
I mean, so the big
thing... But there's technical issues that come up and...
Well, but by far the biggest thing is not a technical issue or anything. It's the fact that the server's been down.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So we purchased a new computer.
Yes.
This last week. I got it set up and running. And I got our... And it's running as a server. Mm-hmm. And at least on the local network, we have the Island CT website up and running.
Yeah.
So that's step one.
Yeah, which is a big step. It's huge.
So that's a lot of work. And then step two is getting that so it's updated to everything we've done so far. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to happen pretty fast. That'll happen this week. And then step three, we're not going back to DDNS probably. Mm-hmm. So... I mean, we're going to go straight to getting a web hosting site and putting it on there that way.
And so the web hosting site is really...
But that might happen pretty fast once it gets going.
I think so. I think I'm going to... Well...
We had several ideas for a long time ago, and then you started looking...
And I found this new one that I thought might be interesting, and we might be going with that. So...
Anyway...
Yeah.
But the reason that we're rushing now is because for today at least we're like more than an hour late because of just stuff happening, including for the second time Audacity and Windows. Well, no, it's not Audacity.
No, it's Windows.
It's Windows. I don't know if it's updates or what, but where suddenly it doesn't work anymore and you have to go navigating through all the GUIs to find the exact button to press. And I hope we can find it again for next time.
And yes, and unfortunately...
We didn't write it down.
Of course not. I'll try to go back over and write it down. But anyway, how about we start with some minor topics that you noticed this week in the news?
Totally fine with me.
Okay.
Oh, you're telling me for me to mention stuff.
I'm following our notes, Pat.
Oh, crap. Okay. Bring up the notes. Minor topics for Pat. Ah, yes. Dot, dot, dot. Nothing under there. Gotcha. What do I have?
Or you could start with your larger project.
No. So maybe to go over a few things that we're both going to talk about first. There's another article about yeast and opioids.
Yes.
So that we're going to do later.
Yeah, I thought you were going to this one.
Lake Urmia in Iran, we're doing together.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So I have a minor topic here, and I have also science in Iran.
Right.
So that's a different...
This is a different article. It's an overview, and I'm hoping to add to yours.
So we're going to do that together also. So I'll just mention one, I guess. This is actually not news, and this is... So we have we used to have minor topics and major topics in the blogs. Mm-hmm. For the last little while, we've just done kind of everything random because of time. And we just thought the minor topics, a lot of them turn really big as we find out.
Mm-hmm.
We knew more about each other's than we remembered or thought.
Right, because of our discussions through the week as we're finding these things. We're like, hey, did you know?
And so there's no real minor or major topics anymore.
No.
Right. But it's all been stuff that's been in the news or recent discoveries, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I wanted to add is, you know, we have certain topics we're interested in where the stuff is not necessarily going to be new.
Right.
Right. And we get an interest in something and we go look something up. So I thought that we could also do some of these articles that are connected to the stuff we do routinely, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking again, like I had a long time ago, into like sports physiology type stuff, which I really like. And I found a fun article.
Oh, neat.
I found several, but I'm just going to talk about one. Now, after saying, so we're going to include articles that are not just recently published.
Mm-hmm.
This one actually is just in press still, or just been published. You can only get it with this big mark accepted, and you know the
nice
one line every one printed line every two lines. Can't remember what that's called. Anyway, so but it wasn't meant to be.
Right.
Anyway, first author is Lundgren.
Mm-hmm.
It's from, let me see, Norway and United Kingdom. Let me see, Olavs University Hospital in Trondheim.
Right.
And the Center for Elite Sports Research, which is in the Department of Neuroscience at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, also in Trondheim. And the Wells Heart Research Institute in Cardiff. Cool.
Oh, neat.
Let me see. Looking for who's the lab. I don't see the corresponding author here. Let's see. Still not finding a corresponding author. Anyway, authors are Lundgren, Carlson, Sandbach, James, and Jonah. T-J-O with a slash N-N-A. Okay, so let's see. The title, Sports-Specific Physiological Adaptations in Highly Endurance-Trained Athletes. Basically, their big point is that for many years there hasn't been update in research that looked at what are the determinants of VO2 max, with the idea that your basic power you can put out in endurance,
right?
Really, it can be given a measure by your VO2 max, which is the rate at which you can exchange take in oxygen, convert it to CO2 and water, the maximum rate.
Okay, is this like the equivalent of a stress test that they use for testing your heart's capacity, like when you go to a cardiologist, they'll put you on a treadmill and they'll hook you all up? And
I think that, so I don't know, I don't remember exactly how the stress test goes, but the way I remember it with the treadmill, mm-hmm. normally you would reach VO2 max, but you know, unless you're measuring oxygen uptake, you wouldn't know what the VO2 max is. Anyway, the point was, well, you know, what are the determinants of VO2 max, and mm-hmm. how do you get at that? And they measured a whole bunch of parameters in athletes, three groups of athletes. They measured, let me go over to my notes, see. Can't find. Ah, there it is. Okay. Blood volume. Mm-hmm. So they obviously measured VO2 max.
Right.
Hemoglobin mass. They have this thing called brachial endothelial function, and that's what I wanted to...
wonder what they mean by that.
Well, I'm going to... That's okay. The only... So I'm not going to cover the whole article.
Okay.
There was just this one part that I found was interesting. Mm-hmm. But it's basically a function... This brachial endothelial function is how well do your arteries dilate in response to the need of the tissues for increased blood flow, right?
Okay.
But it's very specific because it's brachial, and the brachial mm-hmm. artery is in the arm.
Right.
Let me see, what else? Well, they measured some other stuff, but I'm not going to go into it. and I can't see it right there. Anyway, and they were interested in comparing athletes that used their whole body, ones that used mostly the lower body, and ones that used the upper body. And it's really cool because these are all sports that we're really into. So for the whole body, they used cross-country skiers.
Oh, yeah. You can definitely see that.
You can definitely see
swimmers
that.
Swimmers,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, sort of. But, you know, like how much of a stress are you putting your legs
right.
in swimming, mm-hmm. right? Lower body, they used orienteers, which I thought was funny.
Because you have to hold things, so your arms aren't going to be moving.
Yeah, and just any running sport would be okay.
Yeah.
But they just happen to be the group that
they chose for the study.
I remember, more like a year ago, I had some really cool orienteering articles that I'd looked up in sports physiology journals. I'm going to try to make a list and start going through those again, especially the ones that combine cognitive function and the stress of exercise.
Right.
And how actually your fitness, your cognitive function and your fitness kind of work with each other, in the sense that if you're not fit, you won't be able to, under stress, you'll be under more stress, physical stress, right?
Right.
And you won't
be able
to. And
your clarity of thought won't be as great.
Won't be as good. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I can totally understand that from a very practical point of view.
Well, I mean, everybody makes, you know, the typical stupid mistake at the end of the orienteering run rather than
Or right at the first, you know. Sometimes you just have those moments where you can't find the first one.
Actually, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, it's happened to me.
But that's not from being exhausted.
No.
That's from, like, running off half-cocked.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway. And then for upper body, they used flat water kayakers.
Oh, neat. Which, I was about to say, what would they use upper body for? I was like thinking rowers, but the rowers use their legs.
Yeah, the rowers definitely use their legs and their back muscles.
I'm surprised they didn't use athletes, like wheelchair athletes, you know, because they might have been the better group to use instead of, you know.
Yeah.
The kayakers, because they could do the relays and their events. But anyway,
they were comparing VO2 max and blood volume and the hemoglobin mass and this special function, brachial artery function, in these three groups. Mm-hmm. And I mean, basically, they found that the most interesting, of course, or the most not. I don't know, most interesting, that's not the right word. The most important variable the way I think about it as an endurance athlete is VO2 max. And they did find that the cross-country skiers had higher VO2 max compared to the others. Yeah. Okay. But, okay, so this endothelial function, basically what they measured was what they call flow-mediated dilation. So they put a cuff on the arm. Let me see if I can find. So they take the people to a quiet, temperature-stable room, 23°C about. Let them rest for 10 minutes lying down. And then they're taking images with ultrasound of the artery, right?
Oh, wow.
And they put a cuff around the arm, so I probably like, I don't know, standard blood pressure cuff, mm-hmm. They bring up the pressure to 250 millimeters of mercury for 5 minutes, mm-hmm. which supposedly totally occludes flow.
Right.
And then they deflate the cuff, and so you get suddenly this increased flow. And they're continually imaging with it's ultrasound. And they record for 3 minutes. And they're also recording the electrocardiogram because the flow is going to be slightly different at different times in the cardiac cycle.
Right.
Because, you know, when suddenly the ventricles compress, and suddenly you get the valves that open, then you get increased blood flow into the aorta. But you know, if you were to sense an artery, like on the pulse on your wrist, that's not what you're sensing.
Right.
You're sensing the pressure waves that travel extremely fast, mm-hmm. Through the blood vessels. And I assume if you can sense it, that means that the blood vessels are increasing in size and stretching. And it's a different effect. So I don't know how they put all that together, but basically on an ECG, if I remember correctly, it goes PQRST. So P wave, so this is electrical, mm-hmm. is the atria, changing their electrical activity, so depolarizing. Mm-hmm. QRS is the ventricle going through electrical activity, so the compression would happen, you know, right afterwards. And then T is relaxation. And diameter was calculated as an average of 3 measures synchronized with the R wave peak, measured from intima to intima. So QRS, so R is the really big peak of ventricle depolarization. Mm-hmm. So when they see that, that's the time, so it's always the same time relative to the heart pumping. They measure the, ultrasound, the mm-hmm. size of the artery. And FMD, I already forgot what FMD was. That's their important measure. I have to go way to the top. Flow-mediated dilation. Okay, so basically FMD is the size of the brachial artery, mm-hmm. as they measured with ultrasound. Let's see. So the R-wave, FMD calculated as a percent increase relative to their baseline before the cuff was put on. And they measured it at 30, 60, and 90 seconds. They calculated peak shear rates from that. So they were getting blood flow mm-hmm. velocity also. And the difference in, difference between mean flow velocity at baseline and with the cuff released, gave you a change in the flow, which was used for the peak shear rate. So that doesn't make sense to me, but I think that's what they did.
That's pretty intense, for them to have that information about a patient because they would have to insert something inside the veins.
No, because they're measuring it as a Doppler effect with the ultrasound, I think.
Okay. That makes me feel a little better. Because I was thinking, I don't know if
But they do that type of stuff all the time.
They do. Yeah. They do. I just...
And, I mean, we have heard stories.
I know. I'm just a little wimpy, you know, when it comes to that. So I'm like, I don't know if I'd want to do that.
I know. Anyway, so VO2 max, cross-country skiers were higher than the others. Orienteers were lower than kayakers, which was kind of funny, but there was no there wasn't a significant difference there.
And the kayakers have a larger error bar.
The kayakers have a larger error bar by far.
So,
I don't know if these are standard deviations or standard errors. If they're standard deviations, if they're standard errors, they're huge.
They're huge for the kayakers.
Where did they put the figure one caption? There it is. Don't say.
No.
Anyway. Oh, so there's three graphs there. All VO2 max. Anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I love the way it's finding about cross-country skiers, because I always thought that was an incredible sport for just an overall body workout.
There didn't seem to be huge differences with this, I mean, with this measurement. I mean, it's an interesting measurement. I like the idea of it, but there didn't seem to be... They show some significance in the measurements, but they don't look like... I mean, it looks like there's a lot of overlap.
Okay.
So... Well, maybe not. Let me see. At 30 seconds... Well, it's tricky. You have to look at baselines different, too. Yeah, maybe... Okay, so maybe this is... Okay, maybe this is more significant than I thought. Cross-country skiers... Their diameter at 30 seconds is, for example, 4.5 millimeters... And kayakers also have 4.5 meters, and orienteers have only 4 meters.
Millimeters. I was just millimeters. You. I was like, oops. Right.
So that was marked as highly significant.
Okay.
And that was significant still at 60 and 90 minutes.
Good. Wow. So, that's interesting. Yes. I think that's really cool.
Anyway, so look forward to having more, more of this article looked at. I mean, I didn't get a chance to get all the way through it, but I thought it was an interesting measurement.
Neat. Well, I'll take this moment to pull out my my little stand to put out in the center of a courtyard and stand on my little podium to talk about the importance of vaccinations.
Oh, yeah.
And we have another, we have polio resurfacing in Ukraine and West Africa, and
so did it, was it out of Mali or was it somewhere else?
Mali.
It was
Mali. One of the places. Okay. The cases were unrelated, so that's a little more striking. And I lost the article so that I could talk more about it. Unfortunately, when I had to restart the computer,
because of the whole Audacity thing.
Just to mention, wow, when we have it in Ukraine. And in West Africa, because we're more, there's more traveling going on between countries, definitely.
Yeah.
We just need to be thinking about the vaccinations and keeping everything up to date, especially in young children.
It's so bad that it came back. I mean,
right. And the children, one is 5 years old and paralyzed, and the other one's 10 months old.
So when they say resurgence, I mean, they mean endemic.
Yeah.
Data, right? Because...
And unfortunately, that's why I was clicking around. I was trying to find the article, but I will look later on to see if I can get it before
kind of
the end.
In the same situation I was with this article, yeah, trying to get it at the last minute.
Right, and I had it, and really there was only a few paragraphs, yeah, so it was not going to give us all the information we wanted.
Right.
I do hope that in Science we'll see another article, like little news brief to recap what's going on there.
Yeah.
But just to be mindful and,
yeah,
and be thoughtful about getting our kids vaccinated. I especially feel strongly about polio because my aunt had polio.
Right.
And so when people are like, oh, it's not around, it's no big deal, it's like, well, no, we aren't seeing it here. we aren't seeing it in many places.
Right.
But it's like having the whole herd vaccinated really makes the difference.
And I mean, one of the big, or I don't know if it's a big issue, but one of the scares is that when we had the polio campaign in the U.S., people were getting polio.
Yes.
It was endemic, mm-hmm, here, right? So everybody was being exposed.
Right.
And people had antibody titers, even though they'd never, you know, like were measurable against polio, even though they'd never had polio.
Mm-hmm.
And then start vaccinating people and stuff. And then eventually it disappears from the U.S. as an endemic.
Right.
It doesn't mean there's no one with polio here. Okay, so fine. Then you go, I don't know, how many decades later, and you've got a huge number of people that have been born since then, grown up, and they've had the vaccine, but there's just hasn't been an exposure outside,
right,
of that, right? And the concept of how efficacious the vaccine is in the long term is based on what we know from the time when the whole population,
right,
was being exposed at regular intervals, and that's gone. But polio's still in other places in the world, mm-hmm, and yeah, we're almost there at getting it eradicated, but it shows up every so often, and you can imagine a situation where this is going to get harder and harder to get those last few, because the rest of the population getting less exposed will become, even if they're vaccinated, if a large number is vaccinated, more susceptible.
Right.
Right. And at the same time, you're increasing air travel and increasing large migrations of people
and transportation
through all different,
yeah,
means, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could imagine in a place like the United States where it hasn't been in a very long time that you maybe could have a significant epidemic if people stop vaccinating,
right,
their kids.
Right, and I guess that's the other part of my little soapbox, is that I have friends that I talk to about vaccination, and they're so afraid of the vaccine having secondary effects based on that ridiculous article that doctor published,
yeah,
several,
yeah,
years ago, and has been, you know, disclaimed since then. However, that, you know, somehow that idea hasn't been disclaimed.
Yeah.
And there's always that fear, oh my goodness, but it could cause this. Oh my goodness, that means they're also putting this into their body and that's unnatural.
Yeah.
And I will say it's among my more wholesome organic eating community that I'm having more people,
yeah,
that aren't vaccinating. And it's unfortunate.
There's definitely been vaccinations where bad things have happened.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then there's some vaccines for which there is a chance of complications that are serious, mm-hmm, that are still being used. I've never come across a situation in the news where it looks like a vaccine had really bad side effects for a large number of people and they didn't, mm-hmm, pull it.
Right.
Right. And I've never heard of one where the chance of really bad side effects are minuscule compared to the advantages of having the vaccine.
Right.
So, you know, it's the difference in fear of you know, this strange, nebulous possibility of horrible things happening that's
right.
imagined
right.
compared to the fear effects, which is...
And they get into their car every day and they drive to work.
Yeah, well, that's another issue.
You know what I mean? Yes. But anyway, one last thing about
sure.
vaccines.
Yep.
I just think it's awesome how we have the World Health Organization that looks into these outbreaks and then take steps to get vaccinations to the locations as quickly as they can. And without them, we would be in really rough shape. And it's wonderful to have uh-huh. organizations like that.
Sure. Sure.
Do you want another quickie from me?
Sure.
This is very small. I was so excited. I read about it. I was like, a new fuel. Wow. And I got... I'll open up the article so you can see it too, what I'm talking about. So it's this new fuel that's come out, new fuel source where they're going to use CO2. So, you know, I just kept on thinking, incredible. Oh, this is incredible. Mm-hmm. And yet again, incredible. And then as I read down, okay, so the source.
This was out of Science?
This is Science News.
Oh,
so
okay.
It is not a publication in Science, but what I found is sometimes it's a precursor to a publication that's coming.
Right. It's a news article on the Science magazine
right.
website,
right.
AAAS. Science.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So it's published through AAAS.
Right.
So here we have this new fuel system, where it's taking carbon dioxide, using sunlight, and there are a few steps where it in the reaction in which it produces hydrogen mm-hmm. and carbon monoxide mm-hmm. and then it stitches them together into a liquid hydrocarbon. And sounds good, keeps
this
on sounding great, right?
Yeah, okay.
And then there's the catch that
it sounds
the
like
reactor just... runs on temperatures of 1,000 degrees Celsius.
Okay. So
which suddenly makes it like, ooh, we have to put a lot of energy into this to maintain right. it.
But this is still...
But this is very new. This is yeah. like just...
But this is basically, the energy is not coming from the molecules.
No.
The energy is coming from the sun.
Right. The energy is coming from the sun.
So,
that's converting it into... a so, fuel
right.
that can be used.
Right.
And so, and it's interesting.
I mean, it's interesting. There's two issues here. Is where do you get your energy from? Well, this is just a form of solar.
Right.
And then how do you supply energy to your transportation infrastructure where you have to carry it around with you?
Mm-hmm.
And it can't just disappear because there's no sun or there's
right.
no wind for wind, right? And you have to carry it, so it's got to be compact and very highly... energy dense, meaning joules per
right.
kilogram, right?
And so I think that's what Stuart Leach had in mind when he designed this process,
right.
is that there's still that need for a liquid fuel source.
Yeah.
So we have wind power, we have solar power, but we need something that we can carry around with us.
Sure.
And so, you know, of course, there's a lot of steps that need to be worked out right now. Oil's still cheaper, and but it gives us another alternative that maybe in the next few years can really transform the way we think of energy.
Yep.
So, but
I think all of the developments
in the area are really important. They
yeah.
may not be useful now. They may not be useful like in the long run individually, but the steps and the process to creating that
yes.
may lead to other steps and processes that could yeah. be much more marketable and usable.
Yeah. I'm not as sanguine about the whole process of, I mean, because I like solar, right, which
mm-hmm.
you can't use in cars and stuff, but you know, how much do we really need to get to where we're going as fast as we do?
Right.
And there's this whole biofuels thing, and because I ride my bike to work all the time, well, ride it home from work all the time, and I have to just suck in the fumes, and anything that strikes me as one more way to do come up with an octane substitute just really makes me angry. Because it just makes me think
Patrick is bringing out his other soapbox. equally strong and built up over the years as my vaccine soapbox.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
But interesting.
I mean, it's just like everybody has these ideas about clean fuels that you can transport and stuff. And then it's like, well, you know, the cars are actually not too bad right now, except for the fact that there's way too many of them.
Right.
Which makes the whole place, you know, code orange, like pretty much half the summer and red some days.
Right.
But then you look at the school buses, and actually all buses, you know, even
cars,
and it's like the stuff that they put out when they're going by
is ridiculous. It's like,
why?
Yeah.
Because they're cheaper to make that way, right? I mean, you could come up with something that's not as bad, and certainly the school systems don't have tons of money. So it's like, yeah, whatever you come up with, you can come up with a transportation, a fuel that's used for transportation that's going to be really clean, but are people really going to use it that way? Or are they going to be like, oh, we can do this instead and just spew fumes all over the place? And, well, you know, we didn't have the money for anything better than this.
Right. So
I really hope that electric, you know, and all the battery technology and stuff, even though we don't know how bad that's going to be for the environment in the long run. But I personally, I hope that that works better, because then we're not putting stuff in the air. And I don't know. It just seems to me that once it's in the air, you can't get it. It's very difficult to get it back. The batteries, at least, you know, they're a physical thing that if, as a society, we decide we're going to recycle what we can in the appropriate way and handle anything that's left over in an appropriate way, then it's going to be easier to control than stuff that's put in the air. And also,
I will put in my part about that.
Yeah.
So you think about the air, and I always think about the water. And so I'm much more concerned about what's buried in our ground and how it leaches out into the water.
That's true.
And it's a perspective thing.
That's true.
You know,
it's
I think both of them are things that we have to be concerned about when we
because
make our choices.
Because once it leaks out and it's in the water supply,
it can
it's the same as when it's in the air.
Right. And it can contaminate like in whole areas of water and maybe crops, you know, who knows. So, yeah, we just have to be extremely cautious and...
we just need fewer people. No, I'm... Population... I'd be perfectly happy spewing out smoke, driving my huge SUV and going around all, like that everywhere, and then only taking my bicycle for fun if there were a whole 200 people in Chapel Hill. And we had green days every day, right? It doesn't bother me to create pollution.
Right.
What bothers me is that I'm going to create pollution in an environment where everybody's, there's so many people creating pollution that I'm just part of the problem.
Right. We have to.
Personally.
Yeah.
That's, I don't not pollute as much as I can and try to recycle, because I think that that's the good way to live.
Right.
I do it because I'm in an environment where there's this many people.
And I think you hit the nail on the head. It's like we just, when we're living in with the population that we have today, we have to be responsive to the amount of resources we take from the earth and for the number of people that we are.
Exactly.
And I think you've hit it.
That Gandhi was like wonderful person and really awesome and everything, but really I think some of his economics just made no sense. And so I'm not one of those people that believe, you know, you should save every pencil because of the effect it has on people far away. I just feel that, yeah, we have a responsibility because mm-hmm. of how crowded
right.
we're letting the world become.
Yeah. And also, if you think of the number of resources that the West uses in relationship to other countries, it's mind-boggling.
Per person, yeah.
Yeah, per person, yeah. Yeah.
And altogether, I suppose.
And altogether. Yeah. It's just whatever way you can see the picture better. So what have you moved on to?
I just was making sure that Great. My articles were the right size okay. for whatever you were going for next.
Okay, we could move on to your article. In fact, that's why I had highlighted.
None of these are really mine.
No, they're the ones with joint.
Had, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, and then I'll come back to one other one at the end. So, Iran?
Okay, let me bring this up. Iran. So, I guess, well, the one that I have up is, oh, wait a second, do I have two on Iran?
I'll give some statistics as you're pulling things up.
Well, one of the latest science had a big section on Iran. That's why we're finding all different articles.
Yeah, so
you have
I just
the editorial.
Thought, I have the editorial, so
you
there's
go
a
ahead.
Few facts
yeah.
that I wanted to share. So when I was reading through, and you know, this is part of my own ignorance about Iran and that, just mm-hmm. haven't read a lot about it in the last little while. But Iran is now has a population of...
You're using Zernal.
I am.
Hit the plus.
We'll has a population yep. of 78 million people, and
so 78 million, that's like the U.S. is like 350 million or so.
Why don't you look it up? You have the
not worth the time.
Okay, and there's
that's a lot of people anyway. Yeah. 78 million,
and
it's
about
more than Canada.
4 point.
No, I'm trying to put it in context here.
It's so bad. Well, it's a Canadian slight right there.
No.
Yes, they do have twice the population of Canada. So that doesn't mean anything.
I didn't mean it that way.
Anyway, they have 78 million people. They have 4.5 million university students, which I thought, wow, that's neat. And 2,500 higher education institutions.
Uh-huh.
And I just, you know, as I was reading through, I was like, wow, you know, because we get slighted news stories and that, it's not the whole image of Iran. I was not.
I haven't heard any news story about science or education in Iran.
No, I haven't. That's what I mean. There's none. Yes. So that's why it's like...
Because everything with Iran has to do with, at first, the revolution
right.
and the hostages
right.
under Carter.
Right.
Then support for terrorism. Then the war with Iraq.
Right. So as I'm reading this, I'm like...
And then lately was the,
okay.
oh, we're going to build nuclear weapons. Just
yeah.
behind,
you know, yeah. Like, so, you know, the information, I just didn't have any idea of what was going on there yeah. in terms of education, science, and that. So they have 400 non-governmental scientific associations and
cool.
1,000 science journals, 30,000 international scientific papers annually.
So that's been, from what I read in about science in Iran, one that was more specific about how research has gone on since the revolution.
Mm-hmm. That's
that turned out to be a big surprise to people. And the reason is that for a while, it looked like a lot of their science was going to be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a combination of the revolutionary leaders just having ideas about how to run science that were not compatible with real science, number
mm-hmm.
one. And then number two, the international community putting sanctions on Iran, which even for scientists that really wanted to do a good job, just seemed like it would make it impossible. And so under that situation, how are you going to publish papers?
Right.
Right. And yet, those, a lot of, so you hear they have 1,000,
scientific journals.
Scientific journals. Mm-hmm. And you think to yourself, well, whatever. I mean, they could just be garbage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
but it's those 30,000, well, right. It's hard to tell. Maybe they're good, right?
Right.
I'm not saying there are, but you see 30,000 international scientific papers. I know from the article, a lot of those are at major publications.
Right.
In the West.
Mm-hmm.
Doing science at the forefront of current knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and getting published.
I thought another fact, because I'm the fact finder of just the background information this time.
Yeah.
There's a 20-fold increase in science papers since 1979. Isn't that
79.
Wonderful?
That must have been the revolution.
It was. I'm pretty
because
sure.
Because mm-hmm. when was Carter? In 79, I was in France.
Mm-hmm.
I think 79 was still under the Shah.
Yep.
Because in 80, I think 1980, I could be wrong, but I think 1980 was Ayatollah Khomeini coming back, you know, the deposition of the Shah, the hostage crisis. I think that's right. The summer of 1980, maybe?
Yeah.
Anyway, having trouble remembering exactly.
And the other thing that I just thought was kind of a fun fact is that there's some programs where they're really starting to develop partnerships. And one they mention is in France, where they have scientists partnering up with institutions and on mutual projects to get going. And
did you mention which projects with France?
Okay, so it's called the Gondeshapur program, in which Iran has partnered with France to support traveling scientists.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And the individual projects that are part of that, I don't know.
Right.
So anyway, that's my overview of...
So I can tell you a bit about, you know, what it meant, especially the sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm not going to look up because I'm going to try to do this fast, but off the top of my head, one of the big problems was, for example, because of the sanctions, a lot of technology was not allowed to be exported to Iran. And so when they needed something, they had to wait to get it, or they couldn't get it unless they went through the black market.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a lot of researchers that were Iranian but living abroad really helped their
colleagues
back in Iran by sending in stuff. And so that was good. But then, even if they could get the stuff, one of the problems is, you know, they've stayed on the forefront of, you know, the leading edge of science. And so when they'd send in a paper to be published, if the reviewers came back and said, we need this experiment done, otherwise, how do you know that, blah, 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 right? Well, in the West, it's like, okay, fine, let's hurry up, do that experiment. Get everything's ready to go. In Iran, if paper ever came back like that, then, okay, we need to get the materials to do this. We don't have them. It's going to take forever. And by the time they come in, someone else has done this.
Right.
Because at the forefront, everybody's working on the same
things. And they're competing for resources. And
yeah. So that was one. One thing, some stuff really crazy, like, there was a ban on the import to or the export from of stone to hurt their construction business or industry to make it harder for them to
build.
To build. Yep.
Oh, wow.
And So archaeologists suddenly couldn't anymore, you know. Iran, so how ancient are the ruins and stuff? They couldn't send away artifacts to other places
because
to be
examined. Because it's exporting stone.
Because it's exporting stone, right.
Oh, that's so sad.
And they couldn't get stuff sent to them for them to examine from museums and stuff either, right? Or they wanted to date something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nuclides and any kind of radioactive
material
no good.
Could not come in.
So you
or
can't
out.
Go through it. Yeah. So suddenly you can't date the stuff.
Oh.
Right? So that's all the archaeology.
And your infrastructure just isn't there that you need to, you know, to have the stockpile of that stuff.
Yeah. And even more. So these publications, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a ban on so this was by the U.S., so I guess it would only affect journals that have their, headquarters or are registered somehow in the U.S., but there was a ban on publishing any paper who had an author on it who had as their affiliation, if I remember correctly, I hope I'm doing this precisely, a government, Iranian government lab. So when you look at, okay, they have 1,000 universities or whatever it is, and all these researchers, it's like, well, most of those aren't going to be government labs, but that's not what happened. Because the journals would see an Iranian author and be like, sorry, we're not touching
this. We're not touching it. It's too big of a fire.
We just, you know. And
we don't know what we're getting into.
Exactly.
We don't know if we opened up something that someone could accuse us of.
Yeah.
Oh, how sad.
And of course, they had a huge brain drain, both in terms of their own scientists leaving and also a lot of them, all resources when the Iran war broke out.
Right.
Got transferred to that, and you had a whole generation that just went off to be killed in that war. But it looks like the ones that were able to hang on did some really good work, and it's really increasing now, the number of researchers and active labs.
Mm-hmm.
They had one big project that they're hoping is going to be. It was cool. The Iranian Light Source Facility. This is one of those gigantic laser basic science type thing, and they're building it. And I don't know if it's for this project, but you have the same type of thing that happened, which we read about in Cuba, where you have researchers that really want to solve a problem, and the normal ways to do it just are not available.
Right.
And so they homebrew something, right?
Right.
And I think it's for this, let me look it up again, light source facility.
Mm-hmm.
They needed a super stable voltage regulator or power regulator to control some of this. And that was one of the technologies that you just couldn't get. And a lot of these, one of the problems they had is, you get the technology. If you actually get the machines that you need, you get no service contract. Not only that, but there was some story about them getting a machine from a German company, and the company officials telling them, this is fine. Of course, you have no service contract, but if anything goes wrong with it and you have a part that needs to be fixed,
we're going down there to fix it.
No, this was crazy. It's like, you could send it to us, but we're not sure we're going to be allowed to fix it. And if we fix it, we're not sure we're allowed to send it back to you.
Ridiculous. Why buy that?
Right. So, but anyway, this super stable light power regulator or voltage mm-hmm. regulator. They did some research and they came up with their own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as good as, supposedly it's as good as the stuff you can buy commercially on the market
nice.
For this type of.
Isn't that wonderful?
And it took them a long time. But you know, what's really cool is when you force people to do this and they do it on their own,
mm-hmm.
you two things. You find out they really believe in what they're doing.
Right.
And even though they've been set back in the goal, their mm-hmm. original goal, they have a very, very good understanding of exactly how they're getting there and all the different components.
Right.
And they've built their home industry that mm-hmm. can handle that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And that thing's really cool.
That is.
So I hope Iran just kind of moves away from this whole stupid path that they've taken. And I hope their scientists do well.
Yeah.
And liberalizes a bit. Hey, it's amazing how far they've gone with the stem cell research.
Yeah.
That's the one.
I didn't get into that, so yeah, I'd love
big
to hear
on
more
stem
about
cell,
that.
Yeah, they're big on stem cell research, and that's the area where they've been getting scooped.
Mm-hmm.
They still publish, right, a lot on this, but they get scooped a lot because they try to publish something and there's delays and stuff, and you know,
because
that's a very
it.
Fast moving field.
Yeah.
So
okay.
That's
got it.
Yeah.
Now I understand what you're saying. Okay. So because they can't it's hard to stay at the cutting edge when your journals are either slowing down the rate of taking the Iranian papers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So before we move off of Iran, should we talk about Lake Urmia?
Yes, yes. I thought we could do that, and then.
So I looked up where Lake Urmia was. It's way at the very northwest tip of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
That actually abuts up against Turkey.
Wow.
The southeast, and that's Lake Urmia is like tucked up there, close to the border, and I guess the Caspian Sea would be to the northeast.
Mm-hmm.
Black Sea would be to the west.
So the picture that they've chosen for the title of this article
yeah.
is like a picture of a boat, and it's a large vessel that's tied up at a pier, and you can just see salt beds around it.
Yeah, it's sitting on a salt bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it just totally reminds me of the pictures we used to see of the Aral Sea.
Yeah.
And now it's like...
So sad.
What Aral Sea? It's not
right.
even on maps anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So these lakes, I mean, it's a little bit confusing. They have pictures of... So I guess we should explain a bit.
Yes.
What this is.
We should back up.
This is a lake in Iran that... It's a salt lake.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of others in the world. And like all salt lakes, I think they expand and contract with the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2014, it suddenly just disappeared practically. I think it went down to, let me see if I can find what percentage of, I can't find it, 10%. Yeah, so... If you look at its maximum in the year 2000, it was down to 10%. And basically the southern half is dry. More than that, actually. And there's a bunch of reasons. There are changes in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Under the Shah, there was a lot of wine growing that stopped. And they're growing a lot of plants that are much more water
intensive.
And farming has increased,
mm-hmm.
and of course now it's decreasing.
Right, because they don't have the water to support the farms.
Well, they're damming up the rivers that supply the lake, so they're getting the water, but they've had a drought, so that's possibly a temporary thing. We don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Global warming, or maybe it's just a drought that's
mm-hmm.
going to go away. But what's been happening is, because the lake's going totally dry in
right.
humongous areas, and it's leaving this fine salt flat.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
When the winds come by, the salt gets deposited on the fields way downwind mm-hmm. and destroying the fields.
Yeah.
And so that's a new phenomenon.
Desertification almost from the salt.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know if you'd call it that.
I don't know if you'd call it that, but, you know, the effect is basically mm-hmm. to ruin the crops. And so people are moving away because of that. But they're going to try to save it. So, I don't know. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. It'll take some really interesting engineering to stop the salt from blowing over. Like, it's amazing some of the things they can come up with to solve issues like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and they're doing research and stuff. They have these programs. I mean, the article had a picture of a guy. I don't know if you remember. He mm-hmm. was spraying water over a dune.
Yeah.
It had, like, some bacterial mixture or something.
Right.
And it was to see if he could stabilize the dunes and stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. I think, so we were going to talk about yeast.
Yeah.
But I have a big thing to talk about still.
Oh, okay.
We're over an hour.
Oh, I didn't realize. Okay, yeah. Go with your big thing.
So I can skip biosynthesis of opioids and yeast?
We'll put it off till next time, unless something...
There's going to be so much more interesting stuff.
I know. So it's always like a candy store. You go in, you're like, oh, and it's this and this and this and this. And then you're like, oh, we totally don't have enough.
I know. Every time we start, we're like, well, I shouldn't have talked so long about what was that? The physiology of the thing, because I didn't get through it. But I wanted to start a new segment where we talk about just stuff that's not totally in the news.
Like okay.
Just stuff that was interesting. So that's why I talked about that.
Okay.
But I did talk about it for a while. I'll probably come back to it. So I guess...
future plans? Is that what you're going down to?
Well, no. This is... Let's look at our list. We're going to skip the opioids in the East, right?
Yep, and we'll skip the minor topic of genetic engineering.
Okay. We already decided to skip mantle plumes. Mm-hmm. That should be really interesting.
Yep.
Okay, so I had several things, maybe small ones first. Tell me about Zernal.
Zernal?
Yeah.
Zernal is my best friend. So there's this program. It's open source, and I love it. It's called Zernal, and it's a PDF writer.
PDF annotator.
Annotator, sorry.
But it does other things.
I called it a writer because I'm writing on it, but it's an annotator, and it is a joy to work with. Mm-hmm. And you can load it up on Windows 10, because I just did it on Windows 10. Windows 8... the first time I tried it, which was when it first came out, it did not work. And that's why I stopped using Zernal, because I used it on Windows 7.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm using it on Windows 10. And it's just, you open up a document as a PDF, and it's just, it makes it so much more usable, like if you had just highlighted a document by hand, and you can go back and refer to it and add notes to it as you review it or talk with someone about the article. And I really like it, and it can be saved that way and shared with people so that they can see kind of what you were thinking about and maybe have a conversation with you about what they were thinking. So I love it.
That's awesome. Because I've been using it for so long and I've tried to get used to it.
Yeah, so you switched to something else though.
No.
I thought you switched to something else recently.
I'm still using Zernal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
For some reason,
do you
know
that we talked, Zernal was a topic at an earlier podcast a long time ago?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So if you go on Zernal, this might not... And you hit the help.
Yeah.
And about.
Yeah.
So mine says Zernal 0.4.8, written by Denis Auroux. Do you remember there's MIT does open courseware stuff.
Right.
And I love the physics and the calc ones.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not going to remember this correctly, but I think it's multivariate calculus, the one that for a long time, and I'm sure they still have it, where they have the video lectures,
mm-hmm.
it was taught at MIT by Denis Roux. And I think he's off currently at a university in California.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the point is, I'd come across, I'd gone into the source code of Xurnal because there was some stuff that I didn't like about how it handles where the files are stored and how it looks them up.
Right.
And I'd looked up, tried to look up information, and I saw the name as the main, you know, control of the program, and I'm like, Daniel, oh, that sounds awfully familiar, and it's the same guy that had done the lectures at MIT on multivariate calculus.
Oh, how interesting.
So, I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that is really neat.
Okay, see, so that's Xurnal, X-O-U-R-N-A-L, mm-hmm. and...
So, if you've always wanted to write on a PDF, download Xurnal and try it.
Because there's the Windows version.
Right, and you can open your PDF up with Xurnal and
write on it
immediately. In fact, that's my go-to for when I download a PDF now.
Yep. Okay, really short note. This is a system that I talked a little bit about, and it's evolving.
Mm-hmm.
But I've talked about using GNUplot.
Oh, yeah. And you've been loving it.
I've been absolutely... The more I use it...
As much as I like Xurnal.
Well, it's really different.
It is. Totally different.
But the way I'm using it that I really like right now is... I used to keep track of a lot of the sports we do and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In a file that works kind of like a journal or a log, right?
Right.
I write what we do in certain days and types of exercise, blah, blah, blah. And then in a spreadsheet, I'd keep track of, you know, bicycling and stuff. And it's nice. You can do periodization or just look back over a year or plan, you know, you've got a race coming up and you're like, okay, I'm going to work hard for this month and then I'm going to take 2 weeks off or 1 week off, and then that's the race day, and then blah, blah, blah. And it's work to keep separate spreadsheet that you can plot the stuff and see it and a log file.
Right.
And so what I started to do is some of the lines in the log file are formatted. So, for example, if I start a line with a dot, which is unusual, that means that's going to be a formatted line.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, if I put dot A-E-H-I for arrow high, dash R-D dash bike, and then a number, I biked that many minutes that day, right? At high aerobic, meaning I was really pushing. And then I have a program that goes through, and it searches for all those, and the only other thing that's formatted is the date. It can recognize when the date is. And then it goes through the whole log file, and then it creates an output file that's got columns where it has the date and how much of different types of exercise and so on. And then it runs some scripts. Which are basically GNUplot scripts. So they're written in the GNUplot type language. I don't know what you'd call it. And it automatically makes charts.
Wonderful.
And instead of having to work with both a spreadsheet and a log, which a lot of times one would get updated but not the other and so on, it's just a log. You can just type and you can put notes to yourself and stuff. And then, boop, you run your thing, and it updates all your charts.
Right.
And your charts are not in a spreadsheet. They're just images. So you can take any image program you want, you bring them up, and you look at them. It's just the coolest thing.
Yeah.
And they're just so easy. And so, anyway.
So Patrick is going to share this with you, hopefully, sometime on his blog.
There was one more
because,
thing.
Because,
yep.
You remember we were talking about, Pat and I have been trying to get him back in shape, and we go through periodization of being fit and not fit.
Yeah, that's a different type of periodization.
Not a good thing. Don't do
never
it.
Never again.
Don't. We aren't going back.
We're not going back.
So we.
It feels really good being like going to races and being feeling competitive.
Yeah. Well, right? I'm not quite fit yet. I'm down. I just need to get more fit. Right. I'm building up my endurance. So, but anyway, so one of the things to keep us on track is we monitor our bodies a lot. So we monitor our weight. Pat does his waist.
Those scales that have, they do impedance measurements on your feet.
And
to figure out what your fat content is.
I'm like, what is that? Is your foot like expand or does it
well it has to go
chubbies?
Up the leg and to the other leg, I think.
Oh, okay, got it.
Wait, no, that would be a resistance.
Is it just like
no, it must be it must not go up the leg and down the other.
I was thinking it was like
it
a
must be just
fat pad thing.
Yeah. No, that must be it because it's impedance.
Okay, see, that's what I was thinking it was, and I'm like, well,
is it a capacitive thing? Because that
I'm
would be
sure.
Just the feet, right?
Yeah,
if it's impedance from one leg to the other, then it would be more than that.
Right. I'm not sure how it works.
Anyway,
we should look it up.
Anyway, that would be fun to play with.
Yeah. It would be fun to play
with. Well,
you
have the Fitbit.
I have the Fitbit.
That's
so
really cool.
I keep track of, you know, my weight. I don't do the diet so much because it's more complicated and I spend, you know, just a short amount of time putting in my exercise, my weight, and if I, and my sleep is really interesting to me just because I can look at it. I'm like, I really didn't think I slept that much. How did I get 97.7%? Anyway, so we monitor our bodies a lot and, you know, we're changing up our food, of course, and trying different things and seeing how our energy levels are and how effective we are during our workout. And so I'd really love for you to share this because I don't think we're unique in that way as we're starting to build into this.
Oh, the journal.
Your journal thing.
So this brings up something else. Can I move on to something else?
Yeah.
So I went to the Trilog meeting last Thursday. So this is the Triangle Linux Users Group.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an interesting meeting about how to go about getting jobs in free and open source software areas or IT with free and open source software skills. So it doesn't really apply to me, but it was really interesting to hear what they had to say and stuff, especially with Luke being into computer
and
science. And Isaac, actually.
You know, because they're both
Although
going
Isaac
to be applying.
Sounds like he's pretty set right now.
Well, for 4 years.
Yeah.
And then he's going to be out looking for a job again. I always like to read books on, you know, getting a job for myself, because who knows when you have to find a job, but also because, you know, you have family. They're always searching for jobs and things like that, that you can support them.
Yeah. Anyway, I was one of their big things was you need to put stuff up on GitHub, and
you're going to put it there?
Well,
I think that'd be awesome.
There's a lot of stuff I want to put on GitHub. I use Git just for the articles that I read, you know, going back and forth to different computers, but some other project I've worked, I mean, certainly a lot of the RDF stuff should go on there when I get that done.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe that's the first thing I could put up there.
That would be nice. I think that would be very valuable.
Or maybe the art of stuff. I haven't talked about that yet.
Yeah.
So,
anyway. I think both are important to go up there, and I think they're very different.
Yeah.
You know, they have very different uses, so
yeah.
I think it's good.
Anyway.
So, nice.
So, I have a GitHub account. So, I think I do. I looked at that just a while ago. When I first started using Git. But okay.
Okay.
So I have one last thing, and it's huge.
Okay.
Do you have any other things?
No, I don't, because I put it off to the next time.
Okay.
Okay? Because when you said we're at the time, I'm like, that's okay. We can talk about it next
week. This is not going to take a lot of time. It's just huge for us. But we have coming up in 3 weeks now, the, what is it?
Avatar?
Avatar Club.
Club.
Mm-hmm. Or is that what it is?
Because it's an Avatar Club.
So it's part of the school.
Yep. Right? Well, yeah. It's three teachers putting on a club for students who we think could really benefit from.
So it's not directly under the banner of the school. It's the teachers doing it on their own. Very cool.
So there's three of us. We're taking a group of 15 students, and we would love to take more, but this year we thought we'd keep it to 15, a workable size for us.
Yeah.
And we are focusing on students that do well but need support to really prepare for high school and for being competitive for college.
Right.
So we want them to have the experience, the educational enrichment that other kids that are very successful would get.
Right.
And through you know, their summer camps or whatever. And so we have set up different experiences that they'll have on weekends. So one, they'll be doing more of, you know, computer tech.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the weekend you're coming. They're going to be doing tech things. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing the Makey Makey. Pat's going to be leading us in ARDIF and showing us how to do ARDIF.
Yep.
And we'll also be doing 3D printing that weekend. So we have some stuff set up for them. In the long run, they'll be keeping up with...
So is this... In 3 weeks, is that their first meeting, or have
second? That'll be their second. Their first one, it goes along with social studies and intro into geology.
Gotcha.
So we're going to Okinichi, and we're meeting. It's not very far away.
No, it's
20 minutes away, and we're going to meet with a group of geologists from UNC.
Cool.
And they're going to walk us through and talk about the geology of the area, and we are getting a Native American who's from that Native group to come, and he's going to be with us and share with us part of their history, their oral history of the land.
When is that happening?
It's happening.
That must be like either next week or the week after.
I think it's the week after our orienteering weekend.
That's the one you said for ARDIF.
No. It's after ARDIF, sorry. You have the first weekend.
I have the first weekend.
And then the other one is the ARDIF one, which would work better with geology and that. Yeah.
Anyway,
it's hard for me to keep track.
This is really big for us, for the Island CT whole project thing, because it made it that suddenly ARDF needed to happen a lot faster.
Right.
So we have two transmitters at 80 meters that work, and we thought, well, we really need a third one for this.
Right.
And so I'd been working it on and off, but it was going very slow. And this weekend, I put a lot of work into it. And that was the big thing for me, is preparing for the Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm using most of a design from Rick Strobe, who's, I think, I'm not going to say where from, because I know he's in Europe. I think I know where, but I could be wrong, so I'll just leave it. But I just, this morning, got the power amplifier working.
Very exciting.
So, yeah, I came in here just wanting to be a pest. I was so excited, and he shooed me away.
But
the power, that's huge. And then it needs a driver, and I just figured out, I was rushing to get this done before the podcast. The driver, I'm going to have to switch around because I'm going to use the SI-5351.
So what I thought was most interesting about what you're doing is that electronics is something that you have always had a passion for.
I don't know, you started looking things up. I came really late to it.
You did, because you didn't start until, I think, until we moved
Michigan.
Here.
Michigan. Or no, Michigan.
Was it Michigan? Yeah, because you're starting to do the lights.
Well,
the three switches.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Anyway, he came to it really late. Like it was in, you're in graduate school when you started getting into it and just kind of messing
around
with it.
Yeah, before that, I really didn't do electronics.
And I thought it was really interesting how you were like, yeah, you know, you learn all these little parts and it makes sense, all these little parts. But then when you have like all the components that you're putting together on a board finally, and then you see how all these little pieces of information come together, especially when you were talking about voltage and how the voltage built up, and it's like, aha, no wonder it built up that way because I was using.
Right.
And so I thought it was really neat that you're just getting to the point where you've gotten the understanding, the basic understanding, and the connections between those are like making sense for how things should run, or your expected output of that particular device.
Right.
And I think that's really cool.
Anyway, so that's, I could talk about this for an hour about all the trials and the hair pulling.
Yeah, I know.
But I think we'll leave it because
it is.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
How far? Anyway.
So
what's next? Future plans?
Future plans.
So we've talked about our biggest future plans, right?
Right.
We need to get Island CT server running. Well, it's running, but updated.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need a web hosting site.
Right.
And then we have the Avatar ARDF thing coming up. That's the biggest one.
So we have two of those.
All to be done, I think, all within the next 2 to 3 weeks. Because ARDF within 3 weeks. But everything is going to be built within the first two. Because we're going to have to put all the flags and everything together and plan the actual meet.
Right.
Practice meet, so to speak.
Right.
So.
So, and I also want to really dig into CRISPR. That's my goal.
That's
your
goal?
I was so excited.
I know you found this great article.
I found this great article, and then we had this whole sound bizarro thing happen.
Didn't I say last time we're not ever talking about CRISPR anymore?
I know. and I just have to understand it. I feel at a loss. I think it's going to be something that's going to be so important for some of the capabilities we have now and will be
I think it's gonna
a springboard for the future changes.
I really think it's going to change the world.
I think it will.
It's being applied to so many areas. And
that's why I think I have to understand it. And science, I will say science has this ebook that they've made about CRISPR-9.
Uh-huh.
And I'm hoping it will be as good as I think it will. And I am downloading it and probably starting it tonight with my Zernal.
Zernal, yeah. I'll have to show you PDF TK.
No, just Zernal.
Just Zernal, okay. So that's it.
Oh, and you know what? I think I'll mention in my blog about CRISPR that the Zernal, and I'll put the Zernal link that I use to read it.
Oh, you're going to write a Zernal blog?
Well,
no.
No.
You're going to put it in.
Put it in. Maybe I should just write the Zernal blog
first.
The blog
is separate. Yeah. If you want, we can have a section for notes. For some of our podcasts where we went through and did keywords for all the podcast, so it can be searched. So we could, that's be the place to put it.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Well, okay, so, that's
so there are future plans and time to wrap up.
Yep. Web hosting and ARDF.
Yep. Oh, and we have a great weekend plan thanks to Dave. Yep.
Yeah. Lawler. So that's an orienteering weekend.
Yep. So he's planned this whole orienteering weekend, and we're just feeling really excited and fortunate that we were invited to participate.
Yeah. That was really cool.
Mm-hmm. And And it's in our backyard practically, so we're very excited.
So exciting.
It's like a 10-minute bike ride. Not 15, probably 10.
Well, it depends where you want to go.
Yeah.
We can be over there in less than 10 minutes
right.
if we're going at the north end.
Yeah. Yeah, it depends where he's setting up. Okay, so we should start the wrap-up.
Okay, so thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
And the web hosting site is up.
And the web hosting site is up, which will be soon.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.